You are listening to Your Pod and Your Staff, the podcast of College Life Christian Fellowship at UC Davis. I am Peter Nittler, the college pastor of FBC in Davis, California. And our mission is to shape college-age people from all spiritual starting points into complete and equipped agents of King Jesus. And on this podcast, we hope to have conversations that will form you, encourage you, maybe even make you laugh, and we hope that they would be a source of King Jesus guiding you through this time. So in some ways, this conversation is 3 years in the making, because 3 years ago, we set out with a teaching plan at College Life, a plan that would take our students through the scope of the Christian scriptures in 4 years. And we started with the Gospels in year one, we moved back to the very beginning with the first 5 books of the Old Testament in year two, and we always knew this year was coming. This year, we were tackling the rest of the Old Testament. We were nervous. It's not uncommon to find people who are intimidated by, or put off by, or just downright confused by the Old Testament. So we took it as a challenge. Could we tell the story of the Old Testament faithfully and, you know, interesting? Well, after spending time laying out the groundwork of the story, we were going to spend the spring pointing out themes, showing how the Old Testament connected with the new, and giving our students a glimpse into the beauty and wonder of these ancient texts and how they all point to Jesus. And obviously, Corona got in the way of that, but we didn't want to totally abandon the project, so we set out to try and cover all of it in one podcast. So that's what you're going to be listening to here. I will be joined by CIA agent Stanford Gibson and College Life director Miriam Hamilton, and we are going to stuff all of spring quarter into one pod, discussing themes that tie together the Old Testament in ways that Jesus Christ fulfilled messianic expectations and promises. Now, when I say that we're doing all of spring quarter in one podcast, well, that's sort of a lie, because we thought one of Stanford's talking points warranted just a longer, more in-depth discussion, and so we're going to do that next week on the podcast. And before we get to this week's pod, I want to tell you about two things. I just want to tell you, if you're enjoying the podcast or have questions about the podcast or just want to hang out together, then join us for our quarantine-style lunch bunch. We call it Zoom and Consume. It happens noon on Wednesdays, and you can find the Zoom link on our Slack page. And then one last thing. We are hoping to do an episode later in the quarter made up of us just sort of rapid-fire responding to questions from our listeners. So step one of that plan would be to field some questions. So we want to hear from you. If you have any questions you've ever wondered about Christianity, about Jesus, about the scriptures, about college life, about what Stanford does for a living, now's your chance to ask. Email me your questions at pnittler@fbcdavis.org. But for now, it's Old Testament time. See you on the other side. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Your Pod and Your Staff, which I keep wanting to abbreviate it, which would be Yippius, but it doesn't roll off the tongue like you'd hope. So maybe we could revisit that. But we are back with our triumvirate. I'm here with Miriam Hamilton. Hello, Miriam.
Hello, Peter.
And she's in Malibu, and I'm here with Stanford Gibson.
Hey, Peter.
You are off from a 2-week break on the podcast, and all you've been doing is studying for the next one. So we expect you to be throwing high heat. And Stanford, Miriam, you're the only ones that can see this, but I know that podcasts are purely audio, which makes the world sad because I'm growing a pretty nice quarantine beard. And
right.
I'm sure you can attest. Would you like to attest to its quality to the listeners?
It looks great. I did hear, though, that isn't there some suspicion that you're more susceptible to getting coronavirus with a beard, though?
Yes. So I'm on ultra lockdown now.
But it looks so good. Like,
it does look so good.
It looks like a dad beard.
Yeah. So, okay, guys, I was visited by two College Lifers yesterday at a safe distance, I assure you. But X and Sarah came over to our house, stopped by. X and I live remarkably close to each other, maybe a 3-minute walk. And Sarah said something that shocked me. She said that there was 6 weeks left of the College Life year.
6 weeks?
Which is 6 weeks. It sort of like knocked me out of the stupor because I think I haven't really felt spring quarter started.
It seems like time has been standing still.
I know. Isn't that amazing? And I got really sad, I have to admit. I got sad thinking about the fact that spring quarter in Davis is not happening. Because I think spring quarter in Davis is one of the most magical things in the world. People are outside and the quad is full of the ultimate frisbee, people eating lunch. It's wonderful. So I feel sad that there's people like the freshmen who their last quarter at Davis was like winter quarter, which, to be honest, sometimes sucks big time. And Miriam, you have not experienced quarter in Davis. And so I was feeling sad about that. And then, you know, we had a plan for preaching, which was winter and spring quarter were going to be dedicated to the Old Testament. And we thought, okay, there's some really, really cool things that we want to say about the Old Testament and really cool things we want to help people see. And those are like the themes that are throughout the whole story and then culminate in Jesus. And our goal is to help people see how these two testaments are really related to each other and speak to each other, because we maybe had the sense that people sort of wrote off the Old Testament as like, that's just the mean God. But we thought people will not understand the themes as well if they didn't have like the timeline of the Old Testament, if they didn't have the story. So we decided to do the story in Winter Quarter, and we're going to do the cool themes in Spring Quarter. The problem is the story can be painfully dull at times. And so we were just like, Winter Quarter is already dreary, so we're going to do the kind of dull thing during Winter Quarter so that we can have this glorious release in Spring Quarter. And we thought if they can know the story and get the story well, then the themes will be even better. So the plan worked. I thought we did the Old Testament story pretty well. I was pretty into it. But then we didn't get the chance to actually get the payoff with the themes. That got robbed from us, which was one of the many, many tragedies of the coronavirus. I tell you that because our plan for this podcast is to basically do all of Spring Quarter's cool stuff in one podcast, okay? And to do that, I want to sort of take you under the hood of what we do, the three of us. We'll have this big idea, like we want to do the Old Testament theme. And so what we'll do is we'll usually go to Yeti, the little Nepalese restaurant next to Baskin Robbins, and we all get some tikka masala, and we basically do this little pitch meeting. We go back and forth and say, okay, here's the plan. What could we teach on? What could be the topics? And we joke that, you know, Saturday Night Live is famous for having these Monday morning pitch meetings. Everyone in the room, all the writers and the cast, all pitch an idea for a sketch. Like, everyone's got to have one. And there are some great sketches, obviously, that get on there, but there are also some just terrible ones, I'm sure. And that's sort of what our meetings are like, that we have some gold that gets to become a College Life talk. And then there's some stuff that when you hear it, you kind of say, yeah, well, we'll put that in the maybes. Okay.
I can always tell by the look on Peter's face. Like, I know 5 words in, based on the look in Peter's eyes, if it's going in the maybes.
Yeah, that's right. What we're going to do this podcast is we're going to try and do all of the Old Testament themes that we were going to do and give you little pitches. It's going to be like you're sitting down with us at lunch at Yeti, and we're just going through our pitches of what this quarter could look like. And you'll get some of the content that we were going to speak on that we were really excited to speak on. And that's sort of the goal for this pod. Before we start, y'all, anything you want to add? Anything you want to say?
Only that the lunch special at Yeti is outstanding. It comes in a little lunch tray, and potato salad's outrageous.
At these pitch meetings too, Stanford is adept at coming up with makeshift titles on the spot, and they are almost always title and subtitle. Like, you can't name anything like just it. It's just, it's like, here's the title and then three little subtitles, like Old Testament, cool, fun, interesting, or something like that. He would never do something that
lame. They're always better than that. Yeah. Well, one of the temptations is that sometimes the idea is mediocre, but it has a really cool title, and then I have trouble letting go.
Yeah.
Right.
So here's the plan. We are all going to pitch an idea for what could have been a talk, and what we're going to be talks. And we'll let you in also on some of the stuff that was going to be in the maybes. And then what we're going to do is catch up on some of the messianic themes that Jesus was fulfilling from the Old Testament. So welcome to our pitch meeting. Stanford, you down to go first? Give us your pitch.
All right. So I think one of the themes of the Old Testament that it might not be one of the biggest themes of the Old Testament, but it's one of the themes in the Old Testament that has changed the way I think about life. It's been one of the most practical themes of the Hebrew scriptures for me. And that is just simply its emphasis on generations. One of the things that is really striking about some of the promises God makes in the Hebrew scriptures, for example, right at the very beginning, he promises to Abraham that he will make Abraham a great nation, and that all of the nations of earth will be blessed through him. And so then Abraham leads kind of a long life for a human being.
Yeah.
Has some babies kind of late in life.
Right.
You know, it's an exceptional life, but he gets to the end of the life and he's kind of like a powerful shepherd, right? Like, he has not become a great nation. Like, all of the nations of earth haven't been blessed through him. And then he dies. And I feel like skeptical Stanford could say, well, why is that okay? Why is it okay that God's going around making promises to people that they don't see in their lifetime? And I think that's because the Hebrew scriptures see the world on a different temporal scale. We're kind of post-Enlightenment people, so we evaluate the value of life and promises on the time scale of an individual lifespan. We're individualists. Whether we're conservatives or liberals, we tend to be individualists. We tend to see the world through the lens of me as an individual, which is another reason I think that our theology of suffering is difficult too, because we only see what is happening to us and not how we are embedded in a multi-generational story. And I think that one of the things about the Hebrew scriptures is they have a worldview of how the individual is embedded in a multi-generational story. And it just kind of undermines the ego a little bit to the point where you see, oh, this isn't about me. I'm not super special. I don't have to change the world. I'm part of a multi-generational movement that goes like thousands of years back and potentially thousands of years into the future. It's not my job to make everything right now. It's my job to receive the baton and pass on the baton, right? Like you're the third leg of that relay, but the relay's got like 9,000 people in it. One of the places where this comes out the most is in Psalm 78, which is an Exodus Psalm. This is a, you know, my family did a Passover dinner this year around Holy Week. You know, the Passover is really about telling the story to the next generation and receiving the story from the last generation.
Yeah, yeah.
And Psalm 78 says this, I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings from of old. I just love that. I
think that's amazing.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. Things we have heard and known that our fathers have told us, we will not hide them from our children, but we will tell to the coming generation the glorious deed of Yahweh and his might and his wonders that he has done. He has established testimony in Jacob. He has appointed a law in Israel, which he has commanded our fathers to teach their children, that the next generation might know them. And so there's this idea that we are part of a big story, and the continuity of the Hebrew scriptures between themselves with the New Testament and then on into the present day is one of the things that I just adore about them.
That's so relieving, because so often when we're studying the scriptures, we're studying these people who have done really incredible things, whose stories stand out as uniquely remarkable. And I was realizing the other day that has sort of been internalized in me, that I need to do something remarkable with my life. And it takes up a lot of my thoughts of like questioning, am I sort of fulfilling this grand call, when I think that there's a lot more to be said about, well, are you just doing what you've been asked to do, or just taking some of that pressure off?
I think as you get older, you start to realize that your contributions to the world and the kingdom are going to be kind of shockingly incremental. And seeing that in the scriptures, that God is a kind God and doesn't need lots of heroes. What God is looking for is faithfulness in this generation to carry the story to utter dark sayings from the past generation into the next generation. Okay, so that's helpful. Here's how this has changed my life. I am addicted to efficiency. I hate wasting time. I hate wasting my life. Part of it is because I've kind of bought into this enlightenment modernist thing that I have to change the world or else life isn't worth living.
Yeah, it shaped you even if you haven't wanted it to.
Yeah, that's right. It's like inside me, even though I know that I'm part of this bigger story, that I'm in an individualist culture that tells me that my value is based on my individual contribution. And you know what's not efficient? Children. Children are super not efficient.
No.
Like, I didn't want them. I was like, if I'm going to make a difference in the world, then I'm going to skip that thing, because that is a huge time and emotions suck. And so Amanda and I got married. We were married for 9.5 years and we didn't have children because I didn't want them. They seemed like a waste of time to me. And that was kind of my secular perspective on children, but I kind of spiritualized it by saying, oh, we can do more for the kingdom and for justice in the world if we kind of skip that time suck. And looking at this theology of generations made me realize that the God of the Bible does not evaluate us on efficiency, and that faithfully passing on the legacy of God's movement and God's wisdom from one generation to the next is part of what it means to be a person. You know, I think that we live in a time where households are seen as units of consumption and units of production.
Yeah.
It's a cog in the consumption production tree. And I think a lot of young people are like, yeah, well, children don't help that equation. But actually, the beauty of creating a life and passing on the story and mandate of the kingdom to people that you've literally co-created is super inefficient and super fundamental to what it means to be a person and be made in God's image.
So the thing that I'm thinking about, I don't know if this is an apocryphal quote, but there's some idea floating around that what you should do with your life is where your biggest passion and the world's greatest need meets. Because you should basically have the most kingdom efficient life as you can. And it sounds a little bit like that idea maybe is wedded to enlightenment efficiency, maybe more than what the scriptures are telling us. The scriptures are maybe painting a picture of a slower, less efficient faithfulness. And I say efficient, like the most good that you can possibly do in the amount of time that you have.
Yeah, I think that we are really in the shadow of, you know, American utilitarianism, which is this idea that you want to do the most good possible. And to kind of fail to do the most good is actually potentially moral failure. And obviously, this is in a life stage that most of our listeners are not in.
Right.
But I do think that in college is where I really imbibed the idea that children were kind of a waste of time and not something that, you know, serious people consider. And it really took seeing how contingent the Old Testament message was on passing wisdom and the divine mandate, the creative mandate from generation to generation, for me to say, oh, I actually think I'm missing something here. I think that having and raising children is part of Yahweh's story.
Dude, it's so interesting. I do think it matters for college students. You know, even if you look at the Old Testament, or even just the story of Yahweh, it's radically inefficient. It's like years and years of generations and families and mess ups and like, what are you doing? Just go in and save the day. And he doesn't. It's a long time from being banished from the garden all the way to Jesus. And then it's been a long time from Jesus all the way to complete fulfillment of that whole project. You know, this is radically inefficient from our vantage point. But I think it's really important for college students. A lot of times we think that your vocation has to bear basically the weight of your faithfulness, that you need to do the thing with your life that is going to be the most kingdom good. And what this is sort of saying is your vocation can do that, and it'd be great if it could. But your faithfulness might not be on the scale of what you actually produce in the world. Your faithfulness might be on the scale of something else, like what kind of wisdom are you passing down to the next generation for faithfulness to Yahweh. Does that make sense?
Yeah. As you guys have just been talking, I've been thinking about this poem. I'm going to read it to you. It's a poem by Mary Oliver.
Okay.
It just goes like this. Things take the time they take. Don't worry. How many roads did St. Augustine follow before he became St. Augustine? That's it. That's the whole poem. And
that's good.
You guys were worried when I said I was going to read
it.
Oh,
no, I was not.
I was not even a little worried.
No.
Mary Oliver is known for a lot of nature poetry, and she spends a lot of time contemplating creation. And I like to believe that this poem comes a lot out of that, just being in tune with creation and knowing intuitively that things take a long time to develop, and how she pairs that with St. Augustine, who is one of the most influential people in Christian history. And, you know, his whole story was not straightforward, and it took a lot of turns, and it took a long time for him to become sort of the person that he is. And I don't know how much he was just trying to get there, but it takes a while for people to develop. And I like what you were saying, Peter, about how our vocation isn't necessarily finding this great need and just saying, okay, that's what I'm going to do. And when we take ourselves out of this individualistic culture of it's my role to do something grand in this world, and change it just a little bit to I am a part of a collective community that is together creating something beautiful, then there's way less pressure. And I think that the way that we see vocation becomes more of a story and is maybe more in tune with our actual capabilities. And that's relieving to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my pitch. Looking at the story of the Old Testament, not as a series of individual heroes, which they are certainly not, but the story of God's patience and faithfulness as these flawed people have some modicum of faith and faithfulness in their moment and pass on the story and the movement to the next generation. And, you know, the reason that that animates me is obviously eventually Amanda and I did have kids, and we love it. We love it. We thought we'd hate it. But also, that's why I've been in college ministry for almost 11 years now. What I really believe in is that my generation doesn't matter. I don't particularly matter. What matters is that your generations are now coming to the fore and will pass it on to the next generations, and that God's story will continue to move forward.
That's good stuff, man. I appreciate it. But we're going to have to move faster if we're going to get through these. So I'm going to move. Here's my pitch. I'm about to give you the title, and you're going to think that I substituted a recording of Earth, Wind, and Fire, but I assure you that I'm the one singing it. Okay? So here's the title of the pitch. Do you remember? That's it. I remember when I was in seminary and an Old Testament class, and it was taught by John Goldengay, and the final paper, it was really cool. It was, don't use any sources. Just tell us something from the Old Testament that you think is a major theme and would be useful for the modern church. And through that whole class, I was just shocked at how much this particular theme came up. And it was just this idea that almost everywhere where you look for God to be telling his people to do something, what they're told to do is to remember his previous faithfulness, to remember things that he's already done in the past. So like in Deuteronomy, Moses is imploring Israel to obey and to follow Yahweh. And what he says is, take care and keep your soul diligent, lest you forget the things that your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. Okay, so what he's communicating is that these wonderful things have happened. Like, God has been faithful to you. And this is Moses saying this. He's referring to, listen, we just saw God redeem us and bring us out of Egypt. And we've just seen now even God has been leading us to Mount Sinai. God has been giving us manna every single day. Like, God has been doing amazing things. And so one of the ways that you can just be faithful to him is just remember that. Just keep that in your brain and don't forget that, which seems ridiculous. It would be like me waking up and forgetting that I was married one day. How could you possibly forget that if you've seen such amazing things? But you look at stories like Exodus 32 with the golden calf, and it's like God has literally just brought them out of Egypt, and they are at Mount Sinai, and almost the first second that they can, they're already forgetting the fact that it was Yahweh that brought them through, and they make these golden calves, and they say that these golden calves were the ones that brought us out of Egypt. So this idea of remembering is really hopeful to me because it really lined up with my felt reality that, like, I forget the stuff that God has done. And it seems like the people in the Old Testament easily forget what God has done. And I think in my brain, if I were to have seen what they saw, there's no way I would ever forget it. You know, there's no way I could possibly forget walking through the Red Sea. But over and over again, he's telling them, Isaiah 46, he says, remember this. And again, this is the Exodus story. Remember this and stand firm. Recall it to mind. He's saying, hey, the way to be faithful is to just remember this story. And sort of exactly kind of what you were talking about, Stanford, of passing down this wisdom is to make sure that the next generation can remember also what God has done. And I guess I think that we have this idea that our lives should be chock full of moments where God seems to be showing up in big ways. I so often hear students talking about, oh, I don't really feel God, or, you know, he just feels pretty distant to me. And I think what we think is that we're doing something wrong because we read the stories and we're getting sort of the highlight package. And so important big things are happening at a more frequent rate than they happen the rest of our lives. But why would we be told to remember so often and so frequently, other than if those types of events weren't happening all that often? Like, there weren't exoduses all the time. So they had to remember that the Exodus happened. And that's how you remain faithful to God. I remember in Job 23, he says, I go forward, but God is not there. And backward, but I do not perceive him. On the left hand, where is he working? I do not behold him. He turns to the right hand, but I do not see him there. Job cannot see God anywhere, which I feel like really resembles my experience. Like, sometimes there's moments when I just don't feel God. I don't see God. And those moments convince me sometimes that maybe I've just made this whole thing up. Like, maybe this was just an emotional experience I had. If God's not here with me now, you know, what evidence do I have that God even exists? And what's interesting is that Job gets out of that sort of funk, not by a new thing happening, but a couple chapters later, Job says this, how you have helped him who has no power, how you have saved the arm that has no strength, how you have counseled him who has no wisdom and plentifully declared sound knowledge. And if you notice that, all those verbs are past tense, how you have helped him, how you have saved him, how you have counseled him. Nothing new is happening, but Job is remembering what God has done. Job is remembering that God has been faithful in the past, and that data counts for now. The thing that, again, I find so encouraging about that is that we are so tied to what we're experiencing right now. Like, we think that what's happening right now is all that really counts. So that's great when we're experiencing a moment of God really moving and really shaping. We kind of think, oh yeah, totally. God is so real. God is so for me. I remember having this experience when I was a camp counselor, and it was a junior high week. And I'm not excited for when I get to that point of my parenting phase. They do not thrill me because they're bad at everything. They're like not, you know, like they are not coordinated yet. They make mean jokes. Anyway, so I was feeling like, God, I do not feel you at all. And I feel guilty because I'm supposed to be leading these campers spiritually. And I remember we were singing this song. It's a very simple song. It was, I love you, Lord, and I will lift my voice to worship you. Take joy, my king, in what you hear. And I remember that line, take joy, my king, in what you hear. It was just this radical experience that I had of, it felt like the King Jesus was telling me, Peter, I hear your words. I see you. I take joy in this feeble effort that you're putting out there to love these students. And you're good. I see it. And it's like, it was one of the few times I really felt God's real-time presence in a real way that felt sort of undeniable. And I remember saying to myself, Peter, remember this moment, because there's going to be a time when you don't feel this way. There's going to be a time when you don't feel this strongly that God is real. And this moment happened. Like, this moment still gets to count. And so, yeah, I sometimes call it that we are always under the rule of the tyranny of the present, that the present have so much pull over us. And what God is telling his people over and over and over again to do is that your present circumstances do not get to tell you everything, the whole story about whether I exist, about what my character is. I have done things in the past, and those get to count. And so what you should do to be faithful to me is just remember the wonderful things that I've done. And so that means for us, we have remember the Exodus, remember Jesus on the cross, remember his resurrection, remember how he's built the church, remember those moments that I had at camp where you felt the presence of God. And those moments count and those moments matter and those get to be part of the data that tells you who I am, not just the valley of the shadow of death that you might feel yourself in now. So that's my do you remember pitch.
One of the things I love about the scriptures is that the more you delve into them, the more kind of psychologically sophisticated they are. And I think that the remember theme is a recognition of, you know, what we now call recency bias. That if you're always making decisions based on a trailing indicator, then you're going to make bad decisions. And so this idea that a practice, not just like fleeting efforts to remember, but like a real practice of backward looking and retrending your data with historic data points is really important to understanding reality. And I pulled up some Old Testament data here. And it looks like remember is used 184 times in the Hebrew scriptures. But I'm actually surprised at how it's distributed, because I expected half of those to be in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is the second law. It's supposedly the place where remembrance happens. It's a book dedicated to remembrance. But actually, Psalms has...
I was going to say, it's a lot of Psalms.
Yeah, 46. But what I was surprised is actually Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel are all in the teens. And what's interesting about that is those are books that are written during dark periods.
Yeah.
And so the importance of remembrance during a dark night of the soul or a dark period of civilization, there's a correlation there. And I think it's because God is sophisticated about recency bias and the practices it takes for us to be kind of stable.
Yeah. One of my favorite Psalms ever, you know this, I've taught on it before, is Psalm 77. And it's one of my favorite Psalms because of one line. This psalmist can't sleep. He's in so much anguish. And he says, my soul refuses to be comforted, which is so cool. It's like the soul is active, and maybe sounds like the psalmist is trying to comfort his soul, but it just will not be comforted. It's so cool to me. But he's in the valley of the shadow of death. Like, there's nothing good for this guy. And what gets him out of that is remembering the Exodus story. And again, it's no new thing, but it's remembering how God has been faithful. And the point is that that is supposed to tell you who God is and remind you that that God is with you now. And so anyway, yeah.
I think I have often felt really discouraged because I've had moments where it seems like I am so aware of God's presence and I feel this like moment of commitment to him. And then when that moment passes and I don't act in accordance with that, there's this like huge guilt of like, did that even mean anything? Because now I don't feel like I am experiencing my faith in the same
way. Totally.
And yeah, I remember, Peter, you asked me a little while ago, like, what were moments of like commitment that I had in my faith? And you set up the question in a way that I think you often do of like, aren't those moments just the coolest? Don't you think that that is so important to your faith? And it got me thinking about this idea of like remembering and how it's not there to shame us and to make us feel like if we're not having those moments of deep insight and commitment all the time, then we're doing something wrong. But instead that those few select moments are giving us a vision for the rest of our lives. And when we can institute that as more of a practice and more regularly looking back on those moments, it kind of gives us some assurance when we're feeling confused and when we're feeling like we're not quite sure where we're going, as a guide and a signpost for kind of what to do and what we're all about when we feel like we're kind of in the valley of the shadow of death.
Yeah, totally. So that's my pitch. Merm, what do you got for us?
My pitch is on tracing the messianic arc. I remember in one of my classes in college, it was an interpersonal communications class, my professor was talking about how important it is to always remember that you have never figured anyone out. And even if you've been married to someone for 40 years, there's always more to discover about somebody.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so amazing because I can think of like friendships I've had or relationships I've had where it just starts to feel kind of dead because I have this assumption that like, I know all that I need to know about this person and there's nothing more to discover. There are also relationships I've had where it seems like no matter how much I know about them, there's always more and there's always this excitement and vitality and this hope about like, I get to continue to discover more about this person. And I have been learning a lot about that this year as we've been going through the Old Testament and tracing the story. I've been learning a lot more about Jesus, and I've read through so much of the New Testament, and I've, you know, read things about how Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man, and it's just been a title that I've breezed through and has just become something that I don't even notice anymore. And Jesus has sort of become this figure in my life instead of my Savior, who I have a relationship with. And I get to continue to learn more about him. And one of the huge ways that I get to do that is through the scriptures. So what I was going to speak on was you can trace the identity of Jesus and learn so much more about him through all of these stories in the Old Testament that seem like they have no relevance to him, but are actually giving us like these huge insights into who he believed and believes that he is and what that means for us. And so just to name a few, I think we're going to go into this a little bit more later. In the Genesis account of the garden, in that sort of poetic intro to all of scripture, that poem tells about this serpent who is representing evil, and it provides this framework for someone who will come and crush the head of the serpent, and that the serpent will crush its heel. And it's maybe not specifically saying, like, there's going to be a guy named Jesus who comes and is going to pass through death and liberate us all and bring resurrection life. But it provides and sets up sort of where the story is going. And we see, if we trace that all the way through Jesus, we see the way that he has fulfilled that, and it gives us a deeper insight into who he is. And then we can see all through the New Testament, there's all this imagery and talk of the kingdom of God and of Jesus as king. And even when he's crucified, he's accused of being the king of the Jews. And you trace that back to the blessing on Judah and this idea that the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. And this promise that there will be a king one day who comes through the line of Judah. And that is also solidified through the Lord's promise and covenant with David that his house will be established forever. And then the genealogy of Jesus is given at the beginning of Matthew. And we see that he comes from the line of David. He comes from the line of Judah. And that he is the one, the king, who was promised way back when. And that no one necessarily knew that this was going to be pointing to someone like Jesus. But then when Jesus shows up, we begin to see, like, he is fulfilling all of these covenants in a way that nobody expected. And then Isaiah speaks a lot about this coming suffering servant, and he has these beautiful sort of like visions of the coming one who are recorded as these servant songs. And it talks about the one who would be despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. He says, he was pierced for our transgressions and crushed for our iniquities. And upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. In these songs, we see a vision pointing to Jesus as this servant who would come and die for us ultimately, and the humility of him and what that looks like. And then in Daniel, who was a Jew living in Babylon during the exile, he has this super weird vision of the Ancient of Days on this throne and this Son of Man being presented to the Ancient of Days and being given dominion and glory and the kingdom. And it's a very unusual vision. Then when Jesus shows up, his primary way of referring to himself was the Son of Man. When you hear someone referring to themselves with a certain title, it means something. And that was the primary way that Jesus referred to himself. And so we can draw a lot of conclusions about who he is and his identity from this one title, Son of Man, that we see in Daniel. So my theme was just this messianic arc that we see all throughout the Old Testament, and just the ways that we discover so much more about who Jesus is to us and what it means to be followers of this man who is so much more than just somebody who died on the cross for us. That is true, and that is really important, but I think that the narrative that we're often given as followers of Christ is first and foremost that our sins have been forgiven, and that's sort of the end of the story. But if we really are faithful and diligent in like reading the scriptures and uncovering what they're really talking about, there is so much more to it. It has huge implications for how we live our lives and what it means to be disciples of Jesus. Because if we want to be disciples of him, we have to know who he is.
That's really nicely laid out, Miriam. One of the things you did there is you pointed out how in some ways it seems unlikely that, you know, it's obvious that throughout the Old Testament, throughout the Hebrew scriptures, the various genres of literature, the various authors are all pointing forward to someone. But it seems like they couldn't possibly all be pointing forward to the same someone, right? Like the Genesis passage talks about how this coming someone will be locked in a mortal battle with evil, like cosmically. And then Isaiah talks about this like suffering servant who is also the king who sits on David's throne and is this like wild cosmic Son of Man that is obviously not really a human only like we're used to it. And it just seems like these images are too diverse. They're too scattered. They're all looking forward to someone coming, but it can't be one person who's coming. And then the paradox of Jesus, as Jesus comes, as the God-man who is king and priest and also the servant of all, is this sublime, unlikely way to take all of these threads that look like they possibly couldn't all come together in one future person and kind of blow that up and say, look what God can do.
Yeah, no, I think this is like the most exciting thing. I think, again, everything that we were doing this year was to get to the point where we could have these kinds of conversations, like see how these stories are connected. Like the story of Jesus on the cross and resurrecting, see how this is connected to all this other stuff that's come before it. And in a very, very intentional way, it's like not loose kind of ways, you know? And so actually, I think that's where we want to spend the rest of our time, is sort of unpacking a lot of what you already said, Miriam, but just a little bit deeper on some of these themes. And before we do that, though, to let you know that we're not always this brilliant, okay? We're giving you some of our good stuff. Like I said, a lot of these pitch meetings, we end up with a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor and a lot of stuff does not land. And so we're going to just give you a little bit about, you know, what are the kinds of things that we say that, you know, it's just not always the best. And so this is our little segment we're going to call, we'll put that in the maybes, okay? And so we're just going to give you some ideas that we were really excited about. These are not joke ideas, okay? These are like things that we were like really interested in that, yeah, they made it in the maybe pile. So I can go first. Do you want me to go first?
Please do.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay, so I remember I was in a Genesis class in seminary, and I was being driven crazy because I just never knew, how are we supposed to imagine these people? Are we supposed to imagine them as like human beings now who love things and don't like things and eat and live like normal people just a long, long, long time ago? Or are we supposed to imagine them as in such a radically different culture that nothing of our life is like their life? And honestly, this is going to sound crazy, but I was reading the Abraham and Isaac story, which is when Abraham is promised this son, finally gets a son, and then God tells him to go sacrifice his son, go kill his son, which is just like appalling. And there are people who are talking about it with these very emotional, like, imagine having to lose your son. And I was thinking, well, of course, but there's got to be some distinction with how we see children now versus how we saw children then. You know, I just feel like I've tried so hard to train myself to not import my own culture into the culture of the scriptures that it's like, well, then what can I import? Like, what about my life is the same as their life? And so I kept thinking, if I could know what these people did for fun, then I could feel like, how similar are we? Because I feel like none of the scriptures are anything about like fun or like humor. There's so many rules in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Like, where do you put your number twos? You know, like, how do you bury those suckers? But there's no like, okay, here's how you play Jenga. Or like, here are the rules for Moncala. You know, there's nothing like that. There's no like, how do you do comedy? So I kept thinking, man, if I could just go like get my PhD, I would want to figure out, what was the recreation life like of Old Testament people? Like, what were their actual lives like? Because I feel like then I'd be able to actually see, how similar are they to me and how similar are they not to me? Because certainly they're having fun. Certainly they're laughing at something. That laughter didn't get created in the Enlightenment. So that's what I wanted to do. What do these people do for fun? The problem was, I don't know where to look. I mean, I think that Jonathan and David play like bow and arrow fun. Right? Don't they do something with bow and arrows?
I actually think that that would be a great topic. I would love to see you delve into that. And where I would go with that is the Hebrew festivals. You know, the Hebrews have these like annual festivals where they just shut things down and have fun for a week. Everything's shut down and they're not like praying all the time. They're like eating and dancing and enjoying themselves. But we don't exactly know what that looks like, but I bet it looks really fun.
I feel like the only images that I have in my mind about what it means to have had fun back then come from The Prince of Egypt. God bless that movie.
But like, when you picture the Old Testament people, you're picturing them like pretty boring. You must be.
Yeah.
You see, this is one of the reasons that I think that we need to read all texts imaginatively, particularly ancient texts. I think that it's the iconography and some of the things that we've been led to believe about ancient people that leads me to do that. But if you read some of these festivals, like, their kids were flirting, you know, there was all sorts of shenanigans going on.
Yeah.
I bet it was a blast.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so.
I would listen to that talk, Peter, but let's put it in the maybes.
Yeah, we can put it in the maybes. All right, what did you guys get that maybe was in the maybes?
Okay, well, I have a bunch. I like to throw spaghetti at the wall. One of my favorite ideas is Zechariah and Haggai were almost certainly friends. They show up side by side in your Bible. They're post-exilic prophets, but they actually show up side by side in the book of Ezra. Like, they're kind of a team, always mentioned together. But if you read their books, they couldn't be more different. Zechariah is having these wild, crazy visions of, like, you know, Son of Man type visions of, like, the sky opening up. And he's very much an apocalyptic sort of, like, head in the sky guy. And Haggai is just super practical. Haggai's like, where are we going to get the money to build the door of the temple?
Yeah.
And just a really, like, no-nonsense guy. And I just think these two must have been weird friends. I think that they must have been, like, an odd couple. I would love to do a buddy cop movie. That's a theme, where you have these buddy cops where one of them's the, like, straight-laced, no-nonsense guy, and the other one's, like, the rule-breaker and, like, the crazy yeah. one. Except it'd be a buddy prophet movie. And I'd like to, like, imagine what this friendship would have been like with Zechariah just always, like, doing crazy things and Haggai being, like, the straight-laced one. So that's one of my pitches that I'll just preemptively put in the maybes is the buddy prophet movie with Zechariah and Haggai.
We might have to pull it out of the maybes. That's an awesome idea. Have you seen the other guys? That's literally, I mean, Will Ferrell, Mark Wahlberg. So, like, one of them is Will Ferrell, one of them is Mark Wahlberg. It's good stuff. That's a good idea. What's your next maybe?
Oh, yeah. Zechariah would definitely be Will Ferrell in this picture. And I'm down. I've already cast it. The other thing is we finally broke down and watched Tiger King.
Dude, yes.
It is so disturbing.
Oh, yeah, it's wild.
And so I just want to go ahead and just title this talk Tiger King. And the reason is that I am fascinated by the biodiversity of the prophets. Okay, here is a short list of just like half of the mammals and birds that are in the book of Isaiah. Hawk, porcupine, owl, raven, caterpillars, locust, gazelle, sheep, jackals, ostrich, hyena, lion, ravenous beast. Okay, there's not a tiger in there because tigers only live in Southeast Asia. Okay, so we'll call it Jackal King. But I think the biodiversity in the prophets is really interesting. And the reason it's interesting is because particularly Isaiah, but Ezekiel and Jeremiah do this too, is they use animals to describe a period of mourning. And so, like, for example, in Yosemite right now, they say that the bears are coming out and, like, occupying the campsites, and they're worried about what happens when people go back to the national parks because the wild animals are coming into the civilized places and reoccupying them. And that's the word picture that the prophets are doing. When the Israelites are taken into exile, The wild animals come in and occupy the city. And they use this great biodiversity in order to paint that picture. And so it's actually really sad, but also kind of beautiful in a creation healing sort of way. And also a promise that you will come and return and kind of inherit the land from the jackals. It's a great theme, but I just want to name it Tiger King.
That's so awesome. I'm very intrigued by that. And I wish you could speak on it, but it might be it might be one of those things where the title is so good that you hold on to it for a little too long.
Okay, I got one more, and I'm just going to call it The Hammer. You might have noticed that there's 500 years missing in your Bible. Basically, we end with the Persian Empire, and when we pick things up again with Jesus, we're in the Roman Empire. And it's like, hold on, what happened to Alexander the Great? There was a whole empire in there that we missed. Yeah. And that's because there is 500 years missing between Malachi and Matthew. So did God's faithfulness just stop? Some people call it the silent era. You know, like, was there nothing that happened? No, it's actually one of the most exciting periods of Hebrew history, and there's lots of literature about it. And what happened is that Alexander the Great took over the region. He was a bigger empire than Babylon or Persia, and the Hebrews were once again oppressed. But what happened this time is they actually revolted and they actually won. And they actually got their freedom under a guy named Judas Maccabeus, whose nickname was, I kid you not, The Hammer. And this is just one of the most incredible stories that we don't talk about. I don't know why we don't talk about it. It's amazing. The reason why it's important is because sometimes you can read the Babylonian and Persian exile and you think that's the background of the New Testament, but then things are happening in the New Testament that don't really connect to that because it's not the immediate background of the New Testament. The immediate background of the New Testament is this is a people who had a revolutionary movement and won, and then were reoppressed by the Romans. but they have a recent memory of rebellion and winning and independence. And so that is the political milieu where Jesus comes, and they expect him to be the hammer. And he is this cosmic servant that is king and priest in a different way.
Yeah. Behind the scenes window into college life world, Stanford has wanted to do this particular talk for eons and eons. So he just took the reins and said, if we're doing a maybes pile, I'm going to give this little talk. So
I like it. Mine is inspired by my small group. This goes out to Christian and Julia and Adam and everyone else in my small group. We are going through Hebrews right now. We've spent a few weeks talking about Melchizedek. It was another one of those moments when I was reading the name and I was like, ah, Melchizedek, I've heard that name. Didn't really realize I have no idea who Melchizedek is.
Oh, yeah.
And then when I went to go like do a little bit of research on it, I found out like a lot of people don't really know who this guy is. He's mentioned in like Psalm 110 and briefly in Genesis, and is one of the central pieces of Hebrews. And so we've been doing some major nerding out in our small group about kind of just different theories on who he is and his significance and all of it. And I honestly know like almost nothing about it. So I want to do some more research on my own. So I think it's a selfish interest.
People don't know that that's like the reason why you give sermons, is so you get to learn it. It's like the best. You just get to become this little expert on this thing, and it's awesome. So I approve. By the way, I also one time was playing Scattergories, and I got the letter M and the category was boy's name, and I put Melchizedek, and they said it didn't count because it's not common enough name.
I bet it can be annoying to play Categories of the pastor.
Yeah. I think I did Josephus one time too. But yeah, so that might go in the maybes. All interesting stuff though. But there's lots of interesting stuff to talk about.
And only so many weeks in the year.
So now you know that not everything that we think makes it to the Tuesday night podium. And probably for the best. But they make our lunches quite entertaining. So it's a good thing to be able to work with you guys. Even our bad ideas are stuff for entertainment and fodder. But let's turn for the rest of our conversation back to what you were talking about, Miriam, about these messianic themes that Jesus is fulfilling, that things are happening in the Old Testament. Maybe at the moment in time that it's happening, it's not totally clear that it's going to be Jesus Christ. But once Jesus comes on the scene, this whole story starts to coalesce. So let's start talking about those. I think, Stanford, you're going to go first.
Yeah. If you think about what are the kind of major ways of reading the Old Testament, there are two groups of schools about how you can interact with the Hebrew scriptures. And some see kind of big discontinuity between the Old Testament and the New Testament. They kind of see the New Testament superseding the Old Testament so that it kind of almost doesn't even matter anymore. But then the ones that I find more compelling, because I do see it as a cohesive story, is the ones that see continuity between the Old Testament and the New Testament. They constantly see them both pointing towards each other. And that's one of the things that I see in some of these messianic themes. The Hebrew scriptures are always telling the same story as the New Testament in creative, artistic ways. And so the first one that Miriam mentioned is right there at the very beginning in Genesis 3:15. And whenever I interacted with some of this material in the past, I always found this one a little underwhelming because it didn't seem like to really nail the details of who Jesus was. But I've come to really love this idea that while God is laying out what the way the future is going to be after the fall. Adam and Eve have sinned, and God is laying out the way the future is going to be. God speaks to the serpent, the tempter, and says, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring, and he shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. And that's sometimes called the proto-evangelion, the proto-gospel. And Paul leans on it in Romans 16 and says, this is the whole story that's coming, is that humans are going to have enmity with these dark forces of evil throughout their existence. And then eventually there will come one who will be injured by evil, but will crush it. And that is the story. And the reason I love it is because I love stories that are crafted in such a way that when you read the end, you understand the beginning. There's a lot of movies like this, Memento, The Prestige, the movies where you have to watch them a second time, because it only is when you see the last scene that you understand the first scene. Inception's like this too. First,
Christopher Nolan pictures.
Yeah, basically. That's hilarious. But it's harder to do with like television series, because those go over multiple years and you have to be really skillful to know how things are going to end. You know, one of the things that Peter probably knows about me, I'm not sure Miriam does, is I've written a couple of novels and a number of short stories. And one of my rules for when I tell a story like that is I will not start it until I know how it ends, because I want to embed the ending in the beginning. And that is why I find this statement, even though it's not super explicit, you've embedded the whole story in the opening scene. Right there in Genesis 3, we get a abstract, essentially, a précis of where the whole story is going to go. And then we get a couple of other promises in Genesis, the Abrahamic promise that God will bless all nations through Abraham's offspring. And then in Exodus, as the story unfolds, Moses says, "And the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you." The idea that there will be a coming prophet like Moses who will lead people in liberation and speak truth and law. And the idea is that this is a theme from the very beginning, from the paleo-narratives in Genesis, then from the generational narratives, and then also the Exodus. The first three major movements of this story are all pointing forward and all have kind of the ending embedded in them.
Yeah, I love that idea because I do agree with you that if you were to build a big theology of Jesus fulfilling Old Testament promises just from maybe that Genesis 3:15 verse, I can see it, but it's taking some leaps of interpretation. But if you see it as, no, this is like the general form of the way the story is going to go, the general premise is that there's going to be something, that's there's going to be someone who's going to come that's going to put all these things right. And that person is going to be attacked by the same evil, but is ultimately going to defeat that evil. It's like, okay, that's the general theme. And then we're going to see how it plays out in all these different scenarios. So I think that's awesome.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. So what else we got? We got the crush the heel.
We got crush the heel. And then we got a king on David's throne, which I talked about a little bit earlier, but I'll go into a little bit more detail now. If you remember from Winter Quarter, we went through the Old Testament in five parts. We moved from Joshua and Judges, this time where the people of God were ruled by these judges, to the monarchy, and this switch from tribes to a nation being ruled by a king. And the people asked Samuel, the last judge, to raise up a king for Israel. And he had this moment of being very offended because he knew that Israel's king was God, and there was this rebellion against God and asking for a human king who would come and rule them like the other nations. But the Lord says to Samuel, grant the request of the people and establish a throne for Israel and to make a kingdom for Israel. And he raises up this guy, Saul, who winds up being this pretty evil guy. And the Lord says, like, I won't be with you. I won't establish my line through you. And instead, Samuel finds another king in David, and he's just this kind of humble shepherd boy. And the Lord says he's going to establish his kingdom through this man. And he eventually makes this promise to David that his house and his kingdom would endure forever and that his throne should be established forever, which at the time could have been perceived as like, okay, David will be this excellent king who will deliver the people. But even David, who was a really great king, who was for the most part very humble and very obedient to the Lord and faithful, has these moments of great downfall where he also falls short of what it means to be a king ruling the people under the goodness and the faithfulness of the Lord. And so there's this disappointment of like, the Lord has promised that the throne would be established through the kingdom of David and through his line, but David is not quite measuring up to our expectations. So what does that even mean? It seems like one of those moments when the Lord's promises and covenants is being broken. But then as we trace that through to Jesus, again, in Matthew, we see the genealogy of Jesus presented, and it shows how he comes from the line of David. And we begin to see how Jesus is the fulfillment of this covenant, and he is the king that we have been waiting for. I mean, Jesus uses kingdom talk all throughout his earthly ministry. And for instance, in Mark, in his account of the gospel, the first recorded words of Jesus are, "The time is fulfilled and the kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel." And we see littered throughout his ministry, Jesus talking about the coming of the kingdom being near. And then finally, when we get to Jesus's death and resurrection, he is accused of claiming that he is the king of the Jews. And the imagery there is just unmistakable because they put a crown of thorns on him and they mock him by putting on this robe and they exalt him and lift him up as if he were a king, but is actually being exalted on the cross. The people who are condemning him are mocking him, but they don't realize that that moment of being lifted up on the cross is actually legitimately the inauguration of Jesus as king. And from that moment, all of history and all of reality has been changed because Jesus is fulfilling in his death and defeating sin and evil. He is fulfilling this prophecy of being the king who would establish his throne and whose kingdom would endure forever. And in that act, he asserts his dominion and sovereignty over death, over sin, and stakes his claim as king of the world.
I don't know if everyone's this way, but I'm just such a sucker for the king language. I just think like the king imagery is just so cool. And it's like, I feel a little bit like I'm a little boy. Like this is the kind of story you would tell to inspire, you know, it's like the Princess Bride, the person telling their grandson, right? This story. And we just watched The Return of the King last night. And just as you were talking, it struck me that Israel was waiting for this king like David to finally restore Israel. And they keep getting just crappy kings just over and over and over again. These kings that just are not getting the job done. And it reminded me of, for those who haven't seen Lord of the Rings, I'll try to do it fast, but like there's the steward of Gondor who is just the worst.
He's just the worst.
Terrible. And he eats that tomato. It like splurts out of his mouth and it is the most disgusting thing. And he's just a horrible, horrible, horrible excuse for a king. And then once Aragorn is in that courtyard in Gondor and is being coronated, it's like, yes, this is what we've been longing for. Like this is a king that's worthy of the throne, who's going to rule us well and is going to bring us into peace. And that just very basic desire and longing and joy of like the right king on the throne, it just captures me. And so anyway,
I think this would have been hard to believe after, say, David's family just turned out to be not great. And there's this long string of kings and people are like, yeah, sure, a king in David's line is going to come and rule forever. That sounds awesome. Let's not do that. And so that would have been hard enough to believe while there was a kingdom. Then the kingdom ended. Like they got exiled. Mm. There was no king on David's throne. And you could imagine that maybe during the exilic period where we have some of these other messianic things coming up, like the servant and the son of man that we'll get to, maybe this fell out of vogue. But actually that this continued to be a theme even while there wasn't a standing king. You should definitely spend a little bit of time in Ezekiel 37. Ezekiel 37 is one of the best chapters. It's the classic Valley of Dry Bones chapter. But after that Valley of Dry Bones passage, there's this interesting figure called the prince in the second half of Ezekiel. But listen to what God says through Ezekiel. He says, "And I will make them one nation in a land, the mountain of Israel, and one king shall rule over them. And I will save them, and my servant David shall be king over them, and they shall have one shepherd. And David, my servant, shall be their prince forever. I will make a covenant of peace with them that shall be an everlasting covenant." And so this idea that there will be a Davidic king that will come and really not just be another mediocre or kind of above average king, but will really change things cosmically in a totally new way, persists throughout even the period where they don't have any kings at all.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I feel like the king imagery is just like riddled throughout this whole thing. So I'm gonna move on to the next one, which is also king imagery. It's the son of man. And I remember being in the Coho my senior year. I think I was reading the scriptures and I was sitting at a table with this very, very kind agnostic gentleman who was asking me questions with a little bit of a bent of like, how do you believe this kind of stuff? But really, really kind guy. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about how Jesus's followers were the ones that made up the fact that he was Son of God, the fact that he was God at all. And he's like, if you notice, like Jesus never calls himself the Son of God. He always talks about himself being a son of man. So he's just like a normal human. And I was just not familiar with the son of man imagery. And I was really, really, really embarrassed and like really worried that like I was believing something that was bankrupt. Like maybe the early followers of Jesus just really wanted him to be divine. And they kept calling him the Christ. They kept calling him the Messiah in the stories and the Gospels. But he over and over again referred to himself as the Son of Man. And like I said, I went home and I was like, this is not good. You know, like Jesus was not communicating what it seems like his disciples were communicating. And so really, I'm going to try and as quickly as I can talk about the importance of this Son of Man thing, because not only is it not a problem for us in terms of like believing in these scriptures or believing in who Jesus said he was, but it was maybe even more pointed than if he had just come out and said, I'm the Son of God. Okay, so as Miriam said, this Son of Man phrase comes from the book of Daniel. And Daniel 7 is a super, super, super important chapter. And it's funny because I often tell people the first six chapters of Daniel are really awesome and really easy to follow. There you got like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You got the lion's den. And then once chapter 7 hits, it is just chaos. So go ahead and just stop there at chapters 1 through 6. But in Daniel 7, Daniel has this dream. And in this dream, there are these four crazy beasts. They're like hybrid creatures of like there's lions with wings and leopards with wings. And they got four heads. And it's just madness. And we're told that these beast creatures were sort of metaphors and images for really evil rulers and their really evil kingdoms, which might seem a little bit strange to us. We kind of think, what's going on? But it's important because if we go all the way back to the beginning of the story, when human beings were created, God creates the beasts of the field and humans, both from the dust of the earth. Like, they're pretty similar, except for he gives human beings this royal task to rule with God. Like, human beings are supposed to be these, like, kings and queens on the earth. Like, this is what we talked about if you were in College Life in Winter Quarter. The beginning of the story is this song that Yahweh sings that he wants to bless his people and he wants to rule with people. So they're set apart from beasts with this royal image. But what happens if you read the story, and we're familiar with this story, is that human beings become convinced by a snake, by a beast, to forfeit that royal identity. The snake, this beast, tells them, actually, you can be more than what God is saying you can be. You can actually be like God. You don't have to just rule with them. You can actually be the rulers. And so in that moment, I want you to sort of picture these two thrones. There's God on the throne, and then there's a separate throne. He wanted human beings to be on with him, ruling this world. But in making this choice, they forfeited that. And so now there's this empty throne next to God, where there's supposed to be a human being, but there's not a human being. And so we see sort of the people of God continually becoming like beasts. Like Cain and Abel, that story where Cain kills his brother, it said that you have this beastly desire in you, and you can overcome it. But if not, it's going to devour you. And so, you know, human beings just over and over again live like beasts. And so it all culminates in this Daniel vision of these four mega beasts. And there's one really, really, really bad one. And the really bad one in Daniel's vision is in God's throne room. And God pronounces judgment on the beast. He says, I'm going to defeat you. You are no more. And that beast is probably Babylon. And so, you know, in that immediate context, it's good news because it means all the Israelites are going to be saved from Babylon. But what he also sees is the Son of Man coming on a cloud who goes to fill that empty throne. And the Son of Man just means human. And so what he's seeing is, oh, eventually there's going to be this Son of Man, human being, who is going to retake the throne that human beings all forfeited. And so now we see this relationship between human beings and God is being restored by this one human being who's going to sit on the throne and rule with God. And maybe that's like David, maybe that's like Moses. But what's interesting is we're told that this human being is going to be worshipped by the people. And you don't worship Moses. You don't worship David. You might revere them. You might respect them, you might follow them, but you don't worship them. And so there's this idea that this human is going to also be worthy of the title of God. And so now we have this human being who is being worshipped. He's worthy of the title of God, and he's ruling alongside God. And so when Jesus says, the Son of Man is here, I am the Son of Man, he's saying, I am that one that you've been waiting for. That's what he says. When he is about to die, he's in front of the high priest and in front of the courts, and they're basically asking the exact same question that I was wanting to ask, of like, just tell us if you're the Son of God. And he says, from now on, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of God and coming on the clouds of heaven. So if you remember, Daniel's vision was of the Son of Man coming on the clouds and then sitting on the right hand of the Father. So he doesn't just come out and say, I'm the Son of God. He says, I'm the Son of Man. I'm this image of finally someone who fulfills what human beings are always supposed to fulfill and who's going to rule alongside God. And then he tells people how to do that. The way to not be devoured by the beast is to forfeit your life and live self-sacrificially. And so if I were to go back in that conversation with that guy at the Coho, I feel like I wouldn't be as embarrassed. It's like, okay, you're reading Son of Man as merely just human being. But what the story wants you to see is that Son of Man is not just a human being, but is a particular human being who's going to rule alongside God and is actually a human being that will be worshipped and who will pave a way for the rest of us to do the same. So that was a lot on the Son of Man.
Yeah, what's important is contextually, they accused him of blasphemy at that point, which means that they understood that what he was claiming is more along the lines of what you're saying he's claiming than your friend thought he might be claiming. I think one of the really interesting things about the Son of Man as it comes up, you know, Ezekiel uses this term a lot too, as it comes up in the exilic literature, is that it's really in contrast to the other one that comes up in the prophets, which is the suffering servant.
Yeah, the suffering servant. And that imagery comes toward the end of Isaiah. Isaiah, really, 52 to 55. And it's funny, that was one of my first favorite verses. Like, back in the Livestrong days, like kind of when I was becoming a Christian, was when Lance Armstrong had the Livestrong bracelets. Mm-hmm. And I was so into this. I heard this passage, Isaiah 53, and it just blew me away. And it was so cool to me that I made my own wristbands. I think it said Pray on it. They were orange, bright orange. And on the bottom of it, it said Isaiah 53. And I was just hoping people would ask me, like, what does Isaiah 53 say? And what's happening in this part of Isaiah is that Isaiah is painting this picture that something's going to have to change in Israel. God's going to have to do something new for them in order for them to ever be restored. So then he starts to have these poems that talk about this servant that's going to come to restore Israel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you might even think, okay, if you're thinking about the Son of Man, you might think, wow, the Son of Man is coming. He's going to rule with God. He's going to free us from everything. He's going to be the king. The king's going to be powerful. The king's going to overtake people. But what we see in the suffering servant literature is that what this messianic king does is he rules in a very surprising way. His mission is to restore Israel and to be a light to the nations, which is everything we talked about in Winter Quarter. Like, that's the whole project of Israel, is to be a light to the nations, to get God the world that he wants once and for all. But he's going to do that through his suffering and through his death. And if you read Isaiah 53, it's like my favorite thing in the world. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain, like one from whom people hide their faces. He was despised, and we held him in low esteem. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. And so this is not the image of a king that you would be expecting. This is someone who is despised and rejected, and says he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him. By his wounds we are healed. And so he's being placed in this image of, he is actually a sacrifice for the sins and the transgressions of the people. So this servant that's going to redeem Israel, the climax, the thing that's finally going to put it right, is not an overpowering king, but a king who's going to be overpowered by the forces and is going to deal with the radical darkness that is in human hearts. And because of that radical darkness, this servant is going to be despised, rejected, and ultimately killed for that. And that through that, somehow, we are going to have peace. Through that, somehow, we are going to have new life. And it's interesting because later on in Isaiah 53, it talks about how God is going to prolong the days of this servant. So he's going to die, but he's also going to have prolonged days. And so he's alive again in this poem. He dies, he's pierced for our transgressions, and he's crushed, but he's also alive. And he's saying he can restore Israel. And it's just like the parallels to Jesus are just pretty transparent. Like, Jesus was this person who came in lowly on a donkey, did not overthrow, but he was a servant who was going to restore Israel and bring light to the nations, but he did it through his death, letting death crush him, going back to the striking of the heel. So I mean, it's like, just get so excited reading Isaiah 53. It's suffering servant and its connection to Jesus really was one of the first things that like really bolstered my faith and thinking, wow, these stories are really connected in a really profound way. And I remember Katie saying to me when we were reading that, it's like, how did they ever doubt that Jesus was who he said he was if this literature was here? Like, this seems so clear and so perfect. So anyway, suffering servant is pretty awesome. And it's kind of fun to put these things all together in one conversation, because I feel like sometimes when I hear someone talking about any one of these, it always feels like, yeah, like, I see how you make that connection, you know, and it feels like a pretty good case, but it doesn't feel totally satisfying all the time. Because it's like, well, you still have to interpret it. It's not like as clear as day, like there is going to be a person named Jesus that shows up and is the Messiah. It's like there's still a little bit of room of like, well, is this the person? And so I understand sort of a skeptical person hearing these things and thinking, yeah, you're just kind of seeing what you want to see. So
I actually have lots of thoughts about that. I think one thing that's important to say is that we're not proving anything here.
Yeah.
Like, in some ways you could think, all right, wow, there are these long streams of tradition pointing towards a coming expected one that seemed to converge in the tradition of Jesus, you know, QED, right? Like, therefore, Jesus is real and true, and the Christian faith is the only reasonable way to organize the world. That's just not the way God orders things. You know, you'll never find an apologetic proof. We just don't think of it that way. There is uncertainty in the context of faith. Otherwise, it wouldn't be faith. It would be knowledge. And there are realms of faith, but faith still enjoys evidence, right? And I feel like these long traditions that are pointing in the same direction, that look like they should diverge but converge in a sublime climax, really is faith building. It really is evidence for the Christian faith. And so part of the question is, well, you know, shouldn't these be even more clear? I'm not sure you get a lot more clear than Isaiah 53, but then Isaiah 53 also looks like maybe it's pointing towards Hezekiah as well. It looks like it might have a double fulfillment. You know, wouldn't it be great if these were more clear? And there's this idea called Goodhart's Law. And Goodhart's Law says that when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to become a good measure. And the reason Goodhart's Law applies to prophecy is that, you know, if something was laid out in great detail, then someone who would want to be seen as the Messiah would try to bang off each of those tick marks, you know? And so, if someone would say, yeah, there's going to be someone who's going to, you know, come from Bethlehem and his name's going to be Jesus. And by the way, he's going to be a carpenter and he'll grow a beard. Then, like, you know, there were lots of people claiming to be Messiah. And that's one of the things that's interesting, is that it's not like Jesus happened and then we said, oh, look at all this, it's pointing towards the Messiah. No, people were waiting for this Messiah and they had different ideas about who this Messiah would be because this literature is so diverse. And so there were lots of people claiming to be Messiah and they would just like check out that box, Goodhart's Law. And so these themes have to converge in something that's really kind of not humanly possible for it all to be just checked off. But I do think that one of the interesting things is there is a sense in which the Messiah is called out by name. I think the suffering servant is everyone's favorite messianic theme who spent time in this. But, you know, number two for me is the branch of the Lord. And the branch of the Lord shows up throughout the prophetic literature. You get it in Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah chapter 11 starts like this. It says, "There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse," which was David's father. So again, we're tying into that Davidic king theme. "And a branch from his roots that shall bear fruit. And the spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and fear of the Lord. And his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord." Then it goes on to say that he'll be a righteous judge and that a little child will lead them on the holy mountain. And it's just a fantastic passage. And then Jeremiah picks up the same theme where Jeremiah says, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he shall reign and deal wisely and execute justice and righteousness in the land. And this is the name by which he will be called. The Lord is our righteousness." And so there's this figure that will be a wise king, but it will be kind of beyond that. It will be a figure whose name will be the Lord is our righteousness. But then Zechariah, you know, Zechariah is the Will Ferrell character in our buddy cop movie, yeah. Right? Just to put things in perspective. And one of the things that we were going to do at the end of the quarter is in week 9 before celebration, I was going to do a talk on Zechariah that was going to essentially be a capstone experience where we kind of take all of the themes and all of the technical material that we'd done for 2 quarters and pull it together into like, how do you actually like take on a book? How do you actually interpret a book? And the branch of the Lord is a theme throughout the book of Zechariah. But let me read you one portion in particular. During the restoration after the exile, there is a priest named Joshua. And God says through Zechariah, he says, "Make a crown and set it on the head of Joshua, the high priest, and say to him, thus says the Lord of hosts, behold the man whose name is the branch, for he shall branch out from his place, and he shall build the temple of the Lord, and shall sit and rule on the throne, and there shall be a priest on his throne." And so this is a very disorienting passage,
yeah.
Because he's using this branch of Jesse that comes from the prophetic literature where there will be a messianic growth. And the idea of the branch is that the tree's been cut down. Israel's in exile. But from this stump, a branch will come up, a new thing, a sign of hope. But this isn't just a king. It's a king who's also a priest, whose name is Yeshua, which Joshua transliterated into the New Testament Koine is Jesus, and saying there's going to be this figure who is the branch, who is a king in the line of David, the branch of Jesse, whose name is freaking Jesus. And so there is a sense in which this is sublimely precise. But if you read these without a heart of skepticism, they certainly count as evidence towards Jesus being this really radical, expected figure that is at least super curious.
Yeah. Okay, let me see if I can replay that one. You know, Israel is cut off. That tree of Israel is cut off. They're in exile. They screwed up. No good. But the promise is that there's going to be a branch, and the branch will be from Jesse, which is the Davidic line. And that branch will also be a priest who's going to cleanse Israel. And then that branch will have the name Yeshua, which is Jesus.
That seems to be the way Zechariah 6 reads.
That's tight right there. That's tight. Well, that is spring quarter mostly in one pod. And so thanks for hanging tight with us. Thanks for coming to our little pitch meeting. And it's time to move to our favorite segment, Quarantine Corner. You know, we're in quarantine doing a lot of stuff that we weren't doing before, looking for things to do, and all people are having different experiences. So this is our little chance to give you a little window of what you could be doing in quarantine. Does anyone want to go first, Quarantine Corner?
I'll go first.
Merm.
Well, Peter and I often laugh about how funny it is that Peter studied English and I studied psychology, and like 80% of the students in college life are like STEM majors.
99%.
But my quarantine...
yeah. That's why I'm around, I guess.
Exactly. My quarantine corner this week is that everyone become a poet.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. This is awesome.
My friend sent me a poem that she found on social media that was composed entirely out of the first lines of emails she had received since quarantine started. And she challenged me to make my own. It's very, very easy.
Hilarious.
There's so much good material in my emails. And the opening line to my poem is, "If you're not sure what day it is, you're not alone." So my challenge for everyone is to browse through their emails that they've received since quarantine started, take the first line or the subject line, and just copy and paste it into a Word document, make yourself a poem.
See, this is why we do Quarantine Corner. We're giving stuff to the people. Like, this is unbelievable.
Miriam, that is the most fun I think you can have with old emails.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the quintessential Quarantine Corner. And also, in the short history of the podcast, you have become the record holder of number of poems per episode.
That's true.
Although I'm afraid my poem would read something like, please do your timesheet immediately.
Right, right. Yeah, I did have to do some filtering through my... I will say that the last line of my poem, I am happy to say, is, you have tested negative for COVID-19.
Whoa, there's a story
there.
There's
a story there.
I feel like this poem needs to get posted, or you have to recite it to us.
Right now? You want to hear it?
Or we could open with it next time.
Let's open with it next time.
Okay, my Quarantine Corner is less fun, but still pretty fun. It is not Tiger King, because that is deeply, yes, deeply disturbing.
Yes.
We like board games. We love the old Settlers and the Ticket to Ride. It's a good way for the family to come together, but you know, my 8-year-old just doesn't have the attention span to build a railway from Seattle to Miami. And he gets tired of trading wheat for sheep. And we have started playing Codenames. Codenames
rules.
It's the best. If you are stuck at home with your family and siblings and have trouble enjoying each other, I'm gonna pitch Codenames as important for that context, because I know that Peter felt he needed to define the word ontological for Bronwyn's podcast. I'm going to make him define epistemological for this one. Codenames is an act of epistemological empathy. You have to not only think about how you see the world, but you have to imagine deeply how the other people in your family see the world, which can only be good for relationships. Mm. So without kind of giving you the plot, I'm just going to say that it's a quick game. Unlike some of these other games, you can bang out a couple of sessions in 10 minutes, and it's fun for literally the whole adult family.
I'm going to order Codenames for my family and present it to them as a gift with a card that says, I sense we were having a hard time enjoying one another's company. Hope this helps.
Because in this box is epistemological empathy.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, here's my Quarantine Corner. It's the first ever food Quarantine Corner. And very, very simple, but it's providing me a lot of joy these last few days. I'm a big fan of breakfast, usually an eggs person. But recently, we got these pineapples. And along with the pineapple is cottage cheese. Okay? So my Quarantine Corner is that you enjoy some pineapples and cottage cheese. And here's the thing. A lot of you are thinking, that sounds terrible. And let me tell you this, it's so good. And the reason you think you don't like cottage cheese is that as a kid, you are given cottage cheese because your parents like it, because that's what adults do. They like cottage cheese. But you as a kid thought it looked gross because, listen, it does look gross. It looks disgusting. But you feel like you hate it because of that one moment. Here's the deal. Time to grow up. People, you're adults. You're in college. It's time to cross the line. You're no longer a child. It's time to like cottage cheese. And here's how you do it. You go, you buy a pineapple. Katie said, if you're going to do this, you have to tell them. You have to let the pineapple ripen. Okay, you get the pineapple and let it sit there for a while.
Yeah.
Cut that pineapple up. Stick it in the fridge, nice and cool. And then the next morning, get yourself some cottage cheese. I'd go with Knudsen's pink tub. And have yourself some pineapples and cottage cheese. Here's the thing. If this was in the Great British Baking Show and Paul Hollywood was judging this thing, he would say, it's nice with the creaminess of the creaminess of the cottage cheese with the sharpness of the pineapple. It's really nice. That would sound nothing like Paul Hollywood. That might have even been an Australian accent. But that's what he would say. And so, again, pineapples and cottage cheese, you will love it.
You're giving my dad a lot of ammunition. He's been trying to convince me to eat cottage cheese my whole life, and I usually am not someone who would knock something without trying it, but I guess I never grew up.
You never grew up.
I have to say that just as evidence for Peter's hypothesis that, you know, there are many things that people told me I'd like when I grew up that I have not. I still don't like Brussels sprouts, and I don't feel the need to try anymore. But when I was in my late 20s, I found myself in a mess hall in Afghanistan without a lot of breakfast options, and they had cottage cheese and pineapple, and I tried it again.
It's amazing.
It is
amazing. Unbelievable. So this morning, my child, Mason, enjoyed a little bit of cottage cheese because I'm going to teach him, okay, just start off your life liking this. It's going to do you a lot of good.
I hope this doesn't backfire on you.
Pineapple and cottage cheese, you're going to like it, I promise. All right, that is it for your pod and your staff. Stanford and Miriam, it has been an honor to dive into the Old Testament with you. You both are just the greatest there ever was. You'll be in Cooperstown someday. And Stanford and his big words, thank you, buddy. Epistemology, to save anyone the trouble of Googling it, it is basically the theory of knowledge, the study of how do we know what we know. And so we are almost done with our journey through the Old Testament. And Stanford, like I said, saved one last pitch for an extended discussion we'll be having next week. You're gonna love it. And just so we're clear, okay, the Old Testament is beautiful, but it is like a cast iron skillet. It gets better and more flavorful and more impactful the more you go back to it. And so these are texts not designed to be mastered, but to be meditated upon. And our sincerest hope is not that we answered every question, but that we pave the way for future meditation. And as always, thank you to Josh Paskey and Kyle Jung, who created the music for your pod and your staff. It's sublime. And again, don't forget to send in your questions to pnittler@fbcdavis.org. And finally, to sign off, College Life, we love you more than I go nuts for the shaker that you hear at the end of the podcast. You'll hear it in a second. See you next week.